Judges 17 and 18. Then we're moving into the final section of Judges. The Judges has three sections. Sometimes it's helpful to have the structure of a book in your head. Three sections. Firstly, there's the introductions. I don't know if you can remember that far back now to when we started Judges, but there were two introductions. That was chapters 1, verse 1, up to chapter 3, verse 6. So there's the two introductions. Then there's the main body of the book, which is chapter 3 up to the end of chapter 16. It's the this downward spiral of apostasy. There's 12 judges, and the cycle just repeats itself again and again. But then the final judge, Samson, is this Nazarite figure, the saviour who breaks the spiral, stops this whole stuff keeping on happening again. And then the third section is two conclusions. So you see the pattern, two introductions, the main body, two conclusions. And we're going to look at the first conclusion tonight, which is chapters 17 and 18. But here, just to add another level of confusion for you, chapters 17 to 21, this isn't chronological anymore. These chapters don't happen after Samson dies, which is what you might expect. You might think, well, the next thing happens, Samson dies, and then the story. No. Actually, they happen quite a while before Samson comes on the scene. One of the reasons we know that is because Moses' grandson and Aaron's grandson, they both appear in these stories. If you do the calculations, this has to have been, if you were going to fit it in chronologically, it would come much closer towards the beginning of the book than the end. So why have they been included? And why are they included here at the end of the book? Well, so just over a week's passed now, so I think I feel like I can bring myself to mention this. It's a bit like watching England being slaughtered in the Rugby World Cup final. So you sit down, you watch the 80 minutes or so, you see them getting pummeled for 80 minutes, and then what happens afterwards? They go back to the studio for the post-match analysis. Well, that's what's happening here. This is the post-match analysis. This is, okay, you've seen what happened, but how did it happen? Why did it happen? What's the root of the problem? And the answer comes back to one repeated sentence that comes up again and again in these two conclusions. So we read it in chapter 17, verse 6. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We read something very similar in chapter 18, verse 1. It says again, in those days there was no king in Israel. And you can look over to chapter 19, verse 1, and you'll see the same similar wording there. And then right at the end of the book, the final verse, chapter 21, verse 25, the final conclusion, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So that's how the whole book ends, as well as this conclusion. So four times you've got that same repeated phrase in various slightly different forms. So that's the big lesson we're meant to take from the whole book of Judges. Judges, I think you could say, is a theological treatise on the human heart. What do people do when they don't have a king? What direction does the human heart veer in when it's left all to itself? What will you do when the shackles are removed? When the shackles are off, when you're left to yourself, when there's no restraining influences, what direction will you naturally drift towards? Well, Judges is here saying there is this downward spiral. There's this propensity to lead us towards sin. Our heart will veer us back towards evil time and time again when there's no king in Israel, so to speak. So we're going to look at this first epilogue in chapter 17 to 18. It's an unusual story. It's mixed up. There's all sorts of funny and interesting things going on. I think this is one of those stories where, again, you ask the question, okay, we've read it. How does it actually edify us? How is this going to do us good, this story that we've just read? Remember, it's God's word, so it will. It will do us good as we examine it further tonight. I said it's all about the human heart, so that's going to be our structure for tonight. These chapters show us our hearts. They show us four things about our hearts. Here's the first one. Our hearts are revealed most clearly at home. That's chapter 17, verses 1 to 6. Our hearts are revealed most clearly at home. It's interesting that, this is a summary of life in Israel at the time. It's interesting that the story doesn't start with some huge national battle or some important figure. Actually, the summary starts with a single man named Micah, and we're told he lives out in the sticks in the mountains of Ephraim. Why? Well, because Micah here is your typical Joe Israel sort of figure. He's just an ordinary bloke, if you like, but he represents Israel. The point about Israel is it's filled with Micah-type people. It's almost picked one person at random. Well, everyone in Israel's like this guy. He shows us that just the types of things that are going on in daily life there. So verse 2, he comes to his mother with this confession. He's basically saying, I stole your money. I took the silver. He's stolen from his own mother. You might think, well, it's good that he's admitting it. Good on him. Well done, Micah. But I think you read between the lines. I think what's going on here is he's confessing because his mother's put a curse on whoever has the money. It says the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from me and on which you put a curse. Here it is. Take it back. I suspect he's worried about this curse his mother's put on it. And at the end of verse 2, after he's confessed, her response is to bless him. She blesses the son who stole from her. And then verse 3, she says she's actually going to reward him. She's going to use the money to buy a present, so he gets rewarded for being a crook. Verse 4, she gives the money to a silversmith. He makes a carved image and a moulded image, and they sit there in Micah's house. Verse 5, we're told he's got all sorts of things. He's got a shrine, he's got an ephod, he's got household idols, and then he makes one of his own sons into a priest. Interesting, reading about all this, Micah's name. What the name Micah means? Who is like God? And you read about this huge list of idols he's got here. I think Micah's answer, who is like God, would be all sorts of things. All sorts of people are like God. And the answer to that question is meant to be no one. No one is like God. He's got all sorts of stuff in his hands. Then verse 6, the writer of Judges gives us his assessment of Micah's life. It's interesting, there's a phrase that often comes up throughout the Old Testament. The Old Testament often talks about doing what's right in the Lord's eyes. But here, deliberate contrast, Micah's doing what's right in his own eyes. If you want examples of where it talks about doing what's right in the Lord's eyes, you've got Exodus 15 verse 26. Deuteronomy 6 verse 18. It comes up quite frequently. So what's Micah guilty of? Well, he's stolen from his mother, but more than that, he's guilty of syncretism. Now, if you've not come across the word syncretism before, it's a posh word of saying he's got a pick and mix melting pot approach to religion. He says he worships God, but he picks his own priest. He has a custom-built shrine, never has to leave the house, never has to go and worship anywhere else. It's all convenient for him. He steals from his mother. He takes the bit he likes about God, and he mixes it in with whatever else he wants, whatever idols and images he chooses to have. It's the melting pot approach. Now, if we're not careful, we can have that same sort of mindset. So one good question to always ask yourself is, which are the bits of God you find, I wouldn't want those bits. Which are the bits of your Bible you would rip out if you could? Which are the laws you just sort of brush aside? You think, that doesn't fit with the God I want to worship. What are the sins that are acceptable in your home? The things that you think, that's not a problem, come on. But we're changing God. We're picking and mixing the bits we want. What I want you to notice, though, is where all this happens. The battle here, for Micah, all takes place at home. You've got a man who mistreats his mother behind closed doors, thinks he can get away with it. You've got a mother who curses people. And then, instead of dealing with her son's problematic, you know, theft, she coddles him. She refuses to call him out for his sin. And it's a home where idols are openly worshipped, where idols are seen to be acceptable. So it's right that we should pray for our nation, and that we should want in our nation many to be saved. And it's right that we should pray for our communities in that way. If we want those things, actually, the place to start is ourselves at home. What are the sacred cows in your home? What are the things you'd never say to church people, but you say them at home? What are the things you do at home? The things you watch on TV at home? It's just okay. It's just there. See, Micah's family here, Micah's, in a sense, is a very ordinary story, picked almost, you know, think at random. The point is, this sort of stuff is being repeated again and again throughout Israel. Micah is a tiny microcosm of the whole nation of Israel. Our hearts are revealed most clearly at home. That's what's happening with Micah here. Secondly, our hearts seek God's blessings rather than God himself. That's verses 7 to 13. Our hearts seek God's blessings rather than God himself. So we've met Micah. The next person we're going to meet is this Levite, and he seems to be a bit of a wanderer. He's one of these people who doesn't seem to settle anywhere for long. Because verse 7, he was staying in Bethlehem, but then he goes off in verse 8. He travels somewhere, he's looking for somewhere to live, and he turns up at Micah's house. Now, he said this man's a Levite. Levites, their role was to regulate worship. They were to teach people God's laws. And in Numbers 35... the first 8 verses there. Numbers 35, it describes how they were meant to live in lots of different cities spread out throughout the country. The 48 cities the Levites were given, and the reason they're dotted out in this way is so that they can be teaching people throughout the whole of the nation. And it gives them instructions for the land that they're to be given. So you see the point here? You've got a Levite here who's wandering around, but he shouldn't have been. He has no need for that. God's given him 48 cities. He can live there. He's got a role. He should be teaching the people. In verse 10, Micah sees this opportunity. So he says, stay with me. Be my priest. He's already got his son as a priest, but now he wants this Levite to be his priest as well. And he offers him money. So this is a business deal. Religious services being provided in exchange for money. But there's another problem here. A Levite can't just decide to make himself a priest. God had only appointed Aaron's descendants to be priests. So any old Joe Bloggs can't just decide, well, I'm going to set myself up as a priest. This Levite had his particular role, and he's rejecting that, and he's choosing a different one, one that just so happens to pay very well, being a priest in Micah's house. It's verse 13. I think verse 13 is important. Look at what Micah thinks about all this. He says, now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as a priest. This Levite is his lucky rabbit's foot, his four-leaf clover, whatever you want to come up with for that. I've got my very own Levite as a priest. He's obviously very proud of what he's achieved here. Pulled this off and got this Levite to stay and be his priest. But what it reveals about both Micah and the Levite is this. They both want God's blessing, God's peace, God's prosperity, God's kindness, and they think they can arrange it for themselves. Micah thinks God will be good to him because he's got a Levite as a priest. There's no logic to that. There's a danger. Danger for us is that we can take these sort of Christian things and treat them as our four-leaf clover and say, because I'm going to church, because I serve, because I sing, because I get involved with, because I do these good things, God will surely be good to me. You see how we could substitute a Levite is a priest for pretty much anything in that sentence. Because I do such and such, now God's bound to be good to me. And when we do that, we're seeking God's blessings, but we're no longer seeking God himself. Very insulting thing to do when you think about it. I don't want you. I just want the stuff you can give me. And the question we need to keep on asking ourselves is, do I want God himself? Do I know him? Do I talk to him? Or do I just talk about him? Do I want him or do I just want his stuff? There is a difference between the two, and you can see it in the way that Micah speaks here. Thirdly, third truth about our hearts we learn here is this. Our hearts reinterpret God's revealed will to fit in with what we want. It's chapter 18, verses 1 to 10. Our hearts reinterpret God's revealed will to fit in with what we want. Notice again the repeated refrain. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Chapter 18, verse 1. This links all of this together. There's no king there. So Micah, the Levite, and now the tribe of Dan. They're also doing whatever's right in their own eyes. We're told, chapter 18, verse 1, that they're seeking an inheritance to dwell in. That's because up to that point, their inheritance hadn't yet fallen to them. They'd not received their land that they were to dwell in. So they send out some spies. They've got their sights set on some new land that they can get themselves. Interesting, this has happened before in the Old Testament, hasn't it? Sending out spies to check out the land. You compare it to Joshua chapter 2 verse 1. It's actually very, very similar wording. It seems to be deliberate. They're sending out spies again. But this time, they're spying out the wrong land. Land that hasn't been given to them. Well, they meet the Levite. And in verse 5, they ask him, will our journey be successful? In verse 6, he says, go in peace. God will be with you. He's got no right to say that. But he's just decided he's going to say it anyway. Yeah, you'll be fine. Off you go. He's decided he can speak for God. So verses 7 to 10, they check out the land. They bring back this report. It all looks good. The people living there in Laish are isolated. They're not expecting attack. They won't be able to defend themselves. Here's the problem with all these plans the tribe of Dan are making. They do have an inheritance. Who said at the beginning, oh, we haven't received our inheritance. But they do have one. It's actually recorded in Joshua 19, verses 40 to 47. And it lists there all the territory that God had given to Dan. So the land of Canaan is being sort of apportioned to all the different tribes. You have this bit, you have this that bit over there. They all got their portions that they were to go into the land of Canaan to take. The trouble was the tribe of Dan didn't go and take theirs. Judges 1 verse 34 says the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. They would not allow them to come down to the valley. In other words, they let the enemies push them back. They didn't go and take the land God had given to them. So now they think, well, we still need someone. Oh, that looks easier. We'll go and we'll have that bit over there instead. And not only that, we've got our lucky charm, our priest, and he's telling us that the land is ours. He's saying God will go with us, so it's all okay. You see their error. You see their sin. They don't like what God has said. They don't like what God has told them to do, which is go over there and have that land and fight those enemies. So, well, they just change. We've got a priest who's telling us something different. We found someone who's agreeing with us. We can go over there instead. They're just reinterpreting God's will, finding someone who will say something different for them. How do we do that today? We can find that in all sorts of ways. You can find it in Christians who want it to be okay for people of the same sex to have a relationship. So they go and find a teacher or a book that explains how it's all okay. They'll find someone to support their viewpoint that they desperately want to be true. You'll find it in people who are so keen, so desperate, and I can understand this, for there to not be an eternal conscious place of torment. So they'll go and find a teacher who's written something, saying, oh, well, such and such a teacher says this. There we go. That's the challenge for us again, is what ways are we in danger of doing that sort of thing? Burying certain teachings in the Bible because it doesn't fit in with what I want to be true. What are we burying? Are we burying the verses about what God says about Sundays, the Lord's Day? Or how we're to use our money, or hospitality, or how we're to love our enemies? Yeah, even those people. What are the bits we're burying? We're desperate to find an alternative viewpoint. You know, deep down, it's not what God's word says. You're just trying to find someone who will give you a more convenient interpretation. Then the fourth thing our hearts will do is this. Our hearts measure God's blessing by looking at our circumstances. Verses 11 to the end of the chapter. I'll say that again. Our hearts measure God's blessing by looking at our circumstances. So the Danites, verse 11 onwards, they head up to take the land. They take a little detour. They go past Micah's house. And in verse 16, they stand there at the gate and the 600 men with their weapons of war. You ever seen these TV programs? There's loads of them on, aren't there? Where people with cameras follow the police around, and about 20 police, usually armed and things, go and kick down a drug dealer's door at 5 a.m. in the morning. And it's good fun for us watching at home, and they wake up this guy, and he's just wearing his pants, and he's all confused. And you know, now imagine 600 armed men turning up at your house. So they go in, verse 17, they take Micah's carved image, his ephod, his household idols, his moulded image, 600 of them. Verse 18, the Levite says to them, what are you doing? But they say, shh, quiet, put your hand over your mouth. Come with us, because do you know what we can do for you? You can be a priest for our whole tribe. Instead of just for one man. Well, that's going to be much better, isn't it? And all of a sudden, verse 20, the priest's heart is glad. Because after all, he was only with Micah for the money. So if someone offers him something better, well, great, we'll go there instead. Verse 21 to 23, they carry on with the journey, but Micah chases them and catches up with them. And verse 24, he basically complains, says, oi, you've nicked all my stuff, give it back. Verse 25 to 26, they basically say, go home, turn around, or we'll rip you to shreds, we'll tear you to pieces. So that's what he does. He turns around, he goes back home. Then in verse 26, Micah sees that they're too strong for him. So he's lost all the stuff that was really valuable to him. He's lost his priest, he's lost all his different gods and idols. But by contrast, verse 27 to 29, for the tribe of Dan, they go on, they defeat the people of Laish, they burn the city with fire, and they rebuild it, and they call it Dan. So it all ends really badly in a sense for Micah. He loses everything, but it all ends really well for the tribe of Dan. They get everything they wanted. They get the land. That's where it seems to end up. Now, that's where I think one of the things we're meant to notice here. Why did it seem to end well for the tribe of Dan? Because it's not that they've obeyed, is it? We've talked about that. This isn't meant to be their land. They've found a priest who will tell them what they want to hear. They've decided that's the land over there they want, so they've gone for it and then they've managed to do it. It doesn't end well for them because they obey. And equally, it doesn't end badly for Micah because he disobeyed. This isn't the end of the story. Yet. You know, these Danites could have just concluded, hey, do you know what? Everything's okay between us and God because he's given us the land. So God must be okay with us. What a mistake for them to make. So we could do that too. Look at our lives and think, it's all okay for me at the moment. It's peaceful. It's content. Things seem to be going well. And we could interpret our life's circumstance to mean, that means everything's okay between me and God. Things are fine. But our relationship with God isn't proved by peaceful living circumstances. That's not the measure we should use. Now, equally, could be that we're going through very miserable, tough, painful, suffering, difficult circumstances. It could be that we're losing something so precious to us, but that doesn't mean God's abandoned us. It doesn't mean that we've lost him, because God's blessing isn't proved by our circumstances. Don't look at whether your life is full of peace today to see whether you know God. It's what the human heart naturally wants to do. We naturally want to do what they do. We want to look at our circumstances and think, oh, well, that means God's with me. Or that means God's punishing me. Do you know, it doesn't actually end well for the tribe of Dan in the end. It's just that God's judgment is delayed. You get hints of that at the end of the chapter. How long are they there for? Verse 30, they're there until the day of the captivity of the land. And then at the end, verse 31, all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh, there was a house of God throughout this time. We're being reminded of that. Do you know what happens to the tribe of Dan in the end? You get to Revelation chapter 7, and there's a list of the 12 tribes of Israel there, and the tribe of Dan are missing. 12 tribes, but Dan isn't named. Why not? Because they choose the way of idols. They choose to turn away from God. The judgment was delayed, but it is coming. What a dangerous thing to think, well, it all seems to be okay for me at the moment. It's all peaceful and quiet. But the judgment was coming. It's just it was delayed. There's a final twist in the tale in verse 30 as well. It's interesting that we're not told right until the end the identity of the Levite. All the way through the story, it just says the Levite. But now we're told his name. His name's Jonathan. We're told he's the son of Gershom. And if you've got New King James in front of you, it'll say he's the son of Manasseh. But the original wording doesn't actually say Manasseh. And if you've got an NIV in front of you, the NIV interprets this correctly. It says Moses. So that's the twist of the tale. All this stuff that's been going on, this Levite who's been doing this stuff, is actually Moses' grandson. What actually happened was that a few early rabbis couldn't bring themselves to write the name Moses here, because you know, this is one of the most revered men in our history. And within two generations, you know, the grandson that sat on Moses' lap, perhaps, now he's doing this. So they changed it, but it should be Moses there. Well, let's draw this to a close. What can we learn from this, the first of these two conclusions in Judges? We said we learn about the human heart's propensity towards sin. With no king in Israel, what are people drawn towards? Well, we said that they live dishonest lives at home. They're stealing, they're rewarding sin, they're building their idols. We said they seek God's blessing, but they don't seek God himself. Thirdly, they reinterpret God's commands so they can claim to be obeying him. And fourthly, they see their successes as proof that God is blessing them. The people of Dan think it's all good for us now. Why this repeated phrase, there was no king in Israel? I think we sort of explained the bit about how they're all just doing what's right in their own eyes, but what's the significance of there being no king? Well, it's because a king would have been able to put a lid on all this stuff we've read about. A king could have dealt with Micah's theft and all the idols in his home. A king could have stopped the Levite appointing himself as a priest. A king could have stopped the Danites going off to take land that they shouldn't have taken and redirect them and say, no, it's difficult, but take the land God has given you. A king could have stopped all of this stuff from happening. The kings and governments are there to maintain order, to issue directives and laws, and they can punish Israel. So a king could have stopped so much of this from happening. And that's why we need kings and rulers. That's why whoever our next government is and whoever our next prime minister is going to be, we need them. We need laws. We need the restraint of wickedness, because they stop us doing so much bad stuff that we would do if we thought we could get away with it, if we knew it wouldn't be punished. We need someone to tell us what's right. We need a king, because otherwise we'll just do whatever's right in our own eyes. That's what these verses are saying. This is just the natural condition of the heart. But you know, we need more than just good government. Kings, laws, rulers are great for external acts of evil, but they can't deal with what's on the inside. Now, the law of our land can't deal with our thoughts, can it? It's scary when you hear about people trying to, you know, you read George Orwell's 1984, and it's so scary. He talks about the thought police and think crimes, and he's right in what he's saying. How can you ever police what people are thinking? And that, he's right, and that's the point. Governments and laws can only police actions, stuff on the outside. But we need something more than that. So yeah, this is showing how all these external actions in these chapters meant they needed a king. But ultimately, pointing us towards something bigger than that, we need a king who both issues decrees and enables us to obey them from the heart, on the inside. We need a king who gives a perfect law and forgives us when we fail to keep it in our hearts. And that's where Jesus fits into this storyline. You know, the story shows us what our hearts are really like. And it shows us the need of government and regulation and those sorts of things. But also it's saying to us, you know, whoever your favourite politician is today, don't put your hope in your man, your woman, your party, your particular type of politics, your ideas for prison reform or economic policy or green initiatives or education or all the other things that we can talk about in politics. All our politicians have one thing in common in that sense. They promise change, but they can't deliver real change. It's only Jesus Christ can. Only he can deal with the sin in our hearts. Without Christ, our nation is just like a whole nation full of Micahs, doing all those things. You know, that's the picture we're given of Israel. But with Christ, it's the sort of ruler we need, one who changes our hearts on the inside. So let's sing to close about that great king. I'm going to sing number 54, The Lord is King.